Cocktail College is brought to you today by Tanqueray. I don't know about you, listener, but I'm one of those people that needs a mobile app to track my budget. And I'm going to let you into a little secret. I actually have a line item on mine marked Tanqueray. It's true, because I'm a gin martini drinker and Tanqueray is my martini gin. I'm not ashamed to admit it, I have a Tanqueray monthly budget. But it's not just for martinis. Now, I turn to Tanqueray for any of the gin classics because it always delivers on that classic London Dry profile. You know, Tanqueray's, it's not like a good friend, it's like a best friend, a dependable stalwart that always delivers. Now, if you're looking for cocktail inspiration, well, you know you've come to the right place. But if you're looking for something tailored specifically for Tanqueray, you should head over to www.tanqueray.com now. Because you know what, listener? When it comes to gin cocktails, you deserve the best.
Hey, this is Tim McCurdy, and welcome to Vine Pairs Cocktail College, a weekly deep dive into classic cocktails that goes beyond the recipe with America's best bartenders.
Bijou does mean jewel, and the urban legend, the drinking legend, the bar legend of where this name comes from is from the different colors of these ingredients. Gin for diamond, sweet vermouth for ruby, and green chartreuse for emerald.
You've mastered the martini in Manhattan, and perhaps you just got your hands on a currently elusive bottle of green chartreuse for, say, a last word or Alaska. Where'd you go next? Well, you've landed in the right place, assuming you have already tried those drinks and enjoyed our episodes on them, numbers 45 and 97, respectively. That's right, it's the Bijou, a stirred, spirited up cocktail with a luxurious name and non-negotiable hero ingredient. These are pretty much irrefutable facts, but as is so often the case, things truly start to get interesting when we dive into the conflicting reports and opinions. Do we, for example, actually have vermouth or Grand Marnier to thank for this drink's existence? And what about ratios? Should we absolutely be aiming for 3 ounces total from a 2-1-1 formula, or are we missing a trick by not treating this like a Negroni riff? All good questions. Thanks for asking. Adam Fournier is in the virtual hot seat today, calling in but definitely not phoning it in from sunny LA, where he holds the role of beverage director at Spago Beverly Hills. Now, we love it when guests have a specific connection to the cocktail we're covering or an anecdote regarding how they first came across it. Adam certainly checks both of those boxes and more, which makes him the ideal individual for the Bijou and to give us a crash course on green chartreuse. Listener, it's rubies, emeralds, and diamonds. Once again, it's the Bijou. I just like saying that. And it's all right here on the Cocktail College podcast. It's another virtual recording today here in the Cocktail College studio. Beaming in from LA, joining us is Adam Fournier. Adam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I love the fact that the internet allows us to beam across the country like this.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, have these discussions. If anything, I like the fact that it's taking me to LA. I was just there a couple of days ago, didn't get to spend enough time, was out there with the fine folks from the LA Spirits Awards, though. Shout out to those guys. Wish I'd gotten to spend some more time there, but how are things? How's the weather out there? Is that still good for you guys?
That's always the question, right? Yeah, the weather's good right now. Yeah. We've survived the atmospheric river. Yeah. So we're back to business as usual out here.
Oh, yeah. I like when we get these weird meteorological phrases that come up. There was this one time I remember not too long ago in New York, a couple of years ago, and there was suddenly we all got these iPhone notifications and there was a squall coming. A boom squall or something? And we're like, what is that?
That actually happened to us, something very similar, just a week or two ago. We were in pre-shift for a service, and it's been sunny out all day long. All of a sudden, everyone's phone in pre-shift started buzzing with a flash flood warning. We're like, that's insane.
Yeah.
5 minutes later, crack of thunder, and you couldn't hear anyone talk with how hard it was raining. So,
oh, wow. Well, you know, at the risk of them taking away my green card because I'm talking about the weather too much, like a, you know, stereotypical Brit, we are here instead to talk today about the Bijou. It's one that's been previewed in an episode long ago, but I'm looking forward to us giving it the full attention it deserves today. Adam, before we get into anything, tell us, for those listeners, because I feel like this is one of those, maybe a B-side cocktail, but a banger, a B-side banger. For those listening who maybe don't know it, what's the elevator pitch here?
Absolutely. Bijou is a fancy martini-style cocktail that makes use of vermouth and herbal liqueur, very specifically green chartreuse, which is one of those irreplaceable elements, which makes this one of those drinks that is very unique. It's very hard to plug and play on this without changing the complete identity of the cocktail. And it's something that's stood the test of time. It first shows up in a Harry Craddock's bartender guide in the 1900, roughly right around there. So it's something that's still around, still people love to play with. And it's also kind of amazing because you look at a lot of these old recipes like this where they do sometimes call out these very specific ingredients, like say like the Amer pecan for the Brooklyn or things like that. And these recipes for these ingredients have changed so dramatically that they're not even the same product almost at this point. And then you look at chartreuse and it's something that's stood the test of time even longer than this cocktail has.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, one of those ones, I love this category of drinks as well, or cocktails. It's like old school, pre-prohibition, classic, rediscovered, I would imagine we'll get into around the time of the Renaissance, but also tied, like you said, to that one specific ingredient. I feel like there's probably a ton of cocktails out there that are as good as the Bijou that a lot of us don't know. But does this one also really benefit from, you buy a bottle of chartreuse or you're at the bar and you've got chartreuse and you're experimenting with it and you're looking at what have we done historically with it, and then it leads you to a drink like the Bijou. You know what I'm saying there?
Yeah, I do. I think that there's something, I don't want to say magical, but there is something about chartreuse as a spirit, as a liqueur, as quite honestly like the first liqueur, almost in a way, that sparks imagination, that brings you around to like wanting to try it on its own, and then trying to figure out what to do with it. And it's definitely having, chartreuse is absolutely having a moment in the zeitgeist again, right now in 2024, with all those conversations about the shortages, with it being made by, you know, monks. Mm-hmm. But this is something that seems to be almost kind of cyclical. You can go back to the 70s and there was a major moment for chartreuse with drinks like the Swamp Water, which was essentially, you know, green chartreuse and pineapple, but they were selling Swamp Water kits for you to host parties at home with this. And then that drink kind of evolves into modern classics like the chartreuse swizzle and experimentations like that. So I do think that this is one of those drinks that, you know, you may pick up a bottle of something, but it gives you all this world of opportunity to play around with and see what strikes your palate, what strikes your hosting capabilities, and also what you want to present at your bar.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you gave us a great little insight, a snippet into the history there. I'm not sure whether you want to go back a little further at all, because it's funny that we're having this conversation here about chartreuse, but actually it was another kind of newfangled ingredient, a new kid on the block that was the calling card for this drink, and that wasn't chartreuse at all, was it?
No, it was the vermouth, actually. I think we all kind of take the idea of vermouth a little for granted these days, as we're so used to Manhattans and martinis, and especially with the, you know, the cocktail resurgence over the past, you know, couple decades of moving away from the James Bond ultra dry, just look at the vermouth, don't put it anywhere near me, to moving into things like 50-50s, or even now with a lot of the low and no ABV style menus out there, like reverse martinis, vermouth gets to take center stage again. But this was, like you said, a kind of a new kid on the block. It wasn't something that traveled well, stored well. You look back at Jerry Thomas's original bartender's manual, I don't even think there's a single mention of vermouth, maybe one or two. And then you jump ahead a couple of decades and you start seeing drinks like this where that aromatized wine is adding that complexity to go along with everything else. And those become a bigger part, a much bigger component of these style of cocktails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so fascinating to think of that too. And also just, you know, and we kind of mentioned it in a recent episode or in a recent kind of intro there, that we put Jerry Thomas on this pedestal, and rightly so, as, you know, the professor and all the great work that he did. But imagine that he was operating in a world where he doesn't have this ingredient that's pivotal to, what, three of the most well-known and most beloved classics, right? Yeah. Martini, Manhattan, Negroni.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a crazy existence to imagine. Not one I want to be honest.
I mean, it definitely would not be the drinking world that we live in these days, the same kind of bar atmosphere. Though, to be fair, in his defense, without modern refrigeration, there's a good chance that his vermouth would have been what we would have all been making fun of with our movers and shaker memes anyway. So maybe it's for the best of him that he didn't have it.
I mean, I imagine it was also probably what drinking in the 70s was like, right? It was just like, cold vodka.
Yeah,
or gin,
hey,
you know?
Put it in the fridge. It's a wine base. That'll be my PSA soapbox for the day. I love vermouth. It's complex and it's amazing, but it is a wine base. It is something that is going to oxidize and change over time. So if you open that bottle, keep it refrigerated.
Yeah, that fortification is only giving it at least 2 percentage points of alcohol there. It's really, you know, there's only so much heavy lifting that can do on the preservation front. Adam, and I'd also read here too, and you know, you can't believe everything you read there, but I'd also read that original versions were, I want to say Grand Marnier. Am I making that up?
There is a version of the Bijou that predates the one that we know. I'm blanking on the name of the bartender's manual, but there's one that shows up just before this one that uses Grand Marnier instead. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, which is funny as well, because I'm like, there's another example of a new product. And I think I'd seen one. I believe there's two cities, one Cincinnati, and I forget what the other one was. And I think the Cincinnati one was gin, Grand Marnier, and vermouth, right? I might be making that up. And then there's another city, and it was cognac and Grand Marnier. And I'm like, that almost feels like an early precursor to the sidecar, or maybe the sidecar is already happening at this time.
Yeah, well, I mean, like that, where it's drinking culture and history is so fascinating, because we're all kind of parallel thinking, we're all playing with new things, and we're also telling the history after having a few of these bijoux or martinis ourselves. So how much of it is translated appropriately? But yeah, you look at those evolutions, and you can look at things like the sidecar and trace that back to, say, like a brandy crusta, things that were already being played around with. And you start going, oh, what's this new product? What am I going to substitute this into for something that I may have been using before? I'd say this a lot, and I truly believe it, that the art of mixing cocktails is like the really great American contribution to the culinary world. You don't really see that outside of the United States. And I do think that a big part of that is because of the melting pot mentality of the early days of the country. You have an Irish bartender with, you know, English gin and Italian vermouth and French cognac. You're like, if you grew up with those in your native land, you knew what to do with those Amaros or bitters or things like that. You're suddenly here in the United States, you're like, I don't know what to do with this. Well, let's mix them together and see what happens. And I think that's where a lot of that great inspiration starts to come from.
Yeah, you might even think that using some of those products in that way might be sacrilege if you've grown up with them, drinking them in a certain way. Whereas,
I mean, you can talk to people these days who are like, don't you dare, like the way they want their martinis or the way they drink their spirits. Like, look at whiskey and the debate about scotch and how to drink that, and the people who get all up in arms about that. There is a cultural resonance that comes with food and drink that is undeniable. And I think that is part of what makes so many of these things resonate over time.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. I think that, and one of the true fascinating things about, like you say, drinks are culture. And that's what I think fascinates so many of us about them, beyond the fact that they make us feel good until they don't. But what about yourself, or what about the modern history of this drink? I mean, my understanding, I certainly wasn't in New York at the time. My understanding, or even the US, but is that, you know, as the kind of 2000s roll around, or maybe even a little bit before, this is one of those drinks that does get rediscovered. Does that track with your understanding or experiences? And can you remember your first bijou?
That does track with my experience. I kind of came into the modern cocktail movement as kind of like the second wave. You know, I wasn't in the Sasha Petrosky generation or the Sammy Ross. So I had the benefit of a lot of the research from those guys and what the work they were doing. And definitely the Bijou is something that seems to come out of that look for simplicity and classics. How do you take just really good ingredients and build them into something that is an experience on its own? And I absolutely do remember my first Bijou because my partner, who I've been with for over 8 years now, she was a Lady Chartreuse for many, many years. That's how we actually met.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it was funny. My rep came in, was like, "You want to meet with the chartreuse lady?" I was like, I have all the chartreuses, but yeah, sure, let's meet. And now here, 8 years later, I'm really glad I said yes to that. That's how I got to know a whole lot about chartreuse. So she actually walked me through making my first bijou with her. So that was always a fun experiment. So.
Oh, well, that is, you know, that's wonderful that's something we can call out here today on the episode as well. And I don't know, I mean, before we got on air here, you were telling me about, it sounds like, Adam, you got the hookup there, you know, with the chartreuse hookup. Now things are starting to make sense, folks. You got to go check out if you want to know where it's at. We will dive into that as an ingredient shortly. Before we do, though, and this is kind of a little bit of a spoiler alert, but something I wanted to talk about with this drink that I feel is somewhat notable is ratios, because this is one where the original would have been equal parts. Is that correct? And is that something you stick to, or do you maybe take a different route?
The original recipes for these do kind of call out equal amounts. From my understanding and from some research and people I've talked to in the past, a lot of these, if you look at these old bartender books, it doesn't actually call out ounces or proportions, like one part, one part, one part. And from my understanding, a lot of this was based on what we would now call like a 2 ounce pour, like a jigger, like splitting that across. So there's a little less volume that goes along with them. So I tend to these days not go for equal parts on drinks like this. I find that they can be a little overwhelming on some of the ingredients for the modern palate. You also look back at recipes from even 50, 60, 70 years ago, the sugar content and the palate that we were more accepting of is a lot higher than what we look at now. I mean, you think about the success of the Negroni and how much that changed over even just 20 years, how we went from the sugary puckers of the 90s into getting Negronis out of your Applebee's.
Yeah.
That's a big difference. That's a big difference of what the palate's looking for. So I think that really looking into those is a personal thing. As long as you've got the ingredients right, I think you're doing the right thing on that. I tend to move more into a kind of like a 2-1-1 on this one, with the gin taking two parts to one part of the vermouth and chartreuse. So for me, that essentially means is it ends up being almost like a 50-50, but we're splitting the 50 with the vermouth and chartreuse. So I tend to go more like a 3/4, 3/4, 1.5.
Yes.
And my personal preference actually is also pulling out a little bit of the Navy Strength gin, because we do have such big flavors here that having something that stands up to it, that carries a little more oomph, it can sometimes cut through a little bit of that, though that does make the drink a little bit boozier. So you have to be careful with that. And if I'm remembering my manuals correctly, the original gin called out for by Harry Craddock was Plymouth, which is still a style that exists. And they still make a wonderful Navy Strength gin, which is a little bit of a softer style than many of your traditional London dry. So it's again, that's the kind of place you get to play around with on this drink. Like what gin are you using for this? Like that's the spot that makes it a little bit more personal and gives it the modern touch, I think.
I like that nod to history too as well, because I think that going with the Navy Strength, because on the other hand, right, Plymouth is a very approachable, or it's a nice soft citrusy, you know, it's definitely not got its elbows out as a gin. There's a little bit of bite to it, right? But it's a good one to kind of ease people into a full-on London dry, which I would imagine might be difficult if you're matching that up with, I mean, sweet vermouth and chartreuse. That's a hell of a combination there.
Yeah, there's a lot of really big flavors that are going on there. A lot of botanicals, a lot of bittering agents, both balance out a lot of sweetness. So you really do need to find a player that can stand up to them, which is, again, partially why, like, you know, don't want the two of them warring with each other either. So trying to keep those in balance is also the fun part of the drink.
And I like that ratio that you call out there as well, you know, kind of like 2-1-1, and that being 1.5, not 0.75, not 0.75. Because, again, one of the things that stood out to me when looking at different specs online for this, and again, we shouldn't believe everything that we see online, but I did see it quite commonly be 1.5 gin, 1 sweet vermouth, 3/4 ounces of chartreuse. And the first thing I'm like, well, that just is a weird total volume of ingredients. Yeah. And maybe that works for home, but when you're trying to consider wash lines of modern glasses and glassware and things like that, like that's just going to be an odd cocktail, right?
Yeah, it's very true. And that's a very interesting thing to call out as well, where it's so interesting how much these ratios and volumes are affected by glassware.
Right.
By what we all think of as standard. You know, the giant steakhouse loudmouth martini kind of exists at that proportion because of the size of that martini glass. Not necessarily because it makes the best version of that drink. So that's always something very, very important to consider with any cocktail that you're making, is what glass is this going to go into? Mm-hmm. What kind of ice are you using? That's going to affect your experience for it, because that also is then going to affect your experience of drinking this. If you're serving it up, you know, that drink has got nowhere to go but kind of down. It gets warmer. It's not going to get any more dilute. It's, you know, you've got a limited shelf life. So do you really want a giant bowl of liquid that's just going to get warm on you? And that also affects your sweetness level and your proportions. You start thinking about how we perceive sweet when something is chilled versus when something is warm. Think about how much we love ice cream. Then you think about, oh, that's a lot of sugar.
Yeah.
I would never do that warm. But when it's done right and at that temperature, like, this is the best thing I've ever had. So those are very interesting things to just think about how we're affected by the world around us and the perception of visuals, honestly. Yeah. We're drinking with our eyes.
And, you know, speaking about LA as we were earlier, and on my way to the airport, or actually not on my way to the airport home, but taking a quick detour on the way home for one drink at Musso and Frank's. I like how they've kind of inverted the practice, where they have these lovely, quite small-ish, they're larger than Nick and Nora's, right, for the martini, but they give you the classic serving size with the, you know, it's not absolutely even just like the standard sidecar situation there. That's a classic steakhouse martini. Oh,
absolutely. It's something I absolutely, I don't want to say stole, but definitely incorporated into my program at Spago when I took over, because I was like, look, we're classic LA as well. Like, let's do this right. Let's find this wonderful middle ground where you get to have that full experience, but you're also getting the right version of the drink. It's one of those things that, like, it's one of the most talked about things in the restaurant right now. It's like just that little simple touch of service. And also what I love about that, just to, you know, call it out for a little bit, is like all the stuff that we talk about really is in service of trying to be hospitable, of creating an experience for the guest. And doing that kind of serve builds in a necessary secondary conversation, a secondary touch with your guests when you come over to, like, check in, maybe finish out the pouring from that carafe, see if they need another drink before that's going on, getting ready for the food. Like, it builds in this natural moment of hospitality that then doesn't make it feel awkward, doesn't make it feel forced, doesn't feel like you're upselling someone. Feels like you're just checking in on how their evening's going. What can I do for you? Let's see what we can do for the next one.
That's really smart. I had never considered that, you know, so that shows just how well that works. And not like anyone's being duped, but it's, you know, it's breaking down what could become a, not even an awkward moment, but you know what I mean? Almost transactional moment, which, and that is kind of the nature of going out to eat or drink somewhere, right? Like, at the end of the day, we've spoken about this ages ago, but you folks in the hospitality industry, you love to use the words guests, right? But you would never charge a guest at your house. So there is a certain amount of transaction going on there, but we try and go as far away from that experience as possible and make it feel like you are a guest even when.
Absolutely. Yeah. I often refer to it, I have a theater background. It explains why I'm a bartender. I use a lot of, like, theater terminology for it, where it's like, it's the show. So we're doing the dress rehearsal behind it. And yeah, there's a certain performative aspect for it. But the more you can hide in the wings, the more you can preserve the illusion and the magic. You know, you think about, you know, I love the Magic Castle here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You think about, like, I know it's all a trick, but I want to buy into it. I want to believe it if you make me believe it. And I think that's a big part of our job. Like, I think about this a lot. It's like, what is the reason for you to come have a martini and Negroni, a Bijou with me versus, say, across the street? You know, Dante just opened up right across the street from me. So why would you have a Negroni with me versus them? Why would you have a Bijou with me versus them? There's got to be a reason that's not just, you know, the price point. There's something that's going on there that's different. And that hospitality is where it really comes into. And also being really nerdy and thoughtful about these kinds of things, like thinking about how much proportions go into something is something I most guests aren't going to care about or think about, but it does change their experience with us. Hold on, my dog's barking.
Fantastic.
No, I can totally appreciate that as well on kind of the editorial side of things and writing, you know, good writing, unless you're a writer, maybe like good writing, you should not notice. You just find yourself engrossed in it. Bad writing is what stands out. And that's kind of what you're talking about there. You're like, oh, I cannot make my way through this. You know, this is just like pulling teeth. You're a very descriptive person, which I'm thoroughly enjoying in this conversation. So I'm keen to get your take on this. If you recommend bijou to a guest, how are you describing this drink? What are some of the words you're using beyond the classic, like, well, do you like this or that? Like, what is that profile for you?
Absolutely. Thankfully, I have a little bit of experience with this. Like we were talking about before the episode, we actually have I call it the luxury section. We have a bougie bijou on the menu made with some higher end versions of chartreuse, the chartreuse VEP and the elixir vegetal, which is the original version of chartreuse, just made its way to the States. So when I'm talking about this drink to guests, I describe it as a beautifully floral, rich gin martini that has a depth of complexity that comes from centuries of craftsmanship. And sometimes you get through that full sentence. Sometimes you stop at the first part. But I'm a big believer in this idea of like, let's present a really good drink. And then if you want to dive into it, we can. So let's start there. It's like, right, this is a beautifully crafted, balanced gin martini. It's going to be a little floral and herbaceous. And it's going to give you that right pairing to go along with a little bit of food. I think it's a great way to start your evening off. And then if they want to dive in deeper after that, we can start getting into it and talk about the history and everything that goes along for it. So
fantastic. Yeah. Well, let's get into the ingredients now. You know, you mentioned your preference there for Plymouth Navy strength, which I love. So that would be more, you're looking at the strength, but also the profile of the Plymouth there. Like, what's your thinking?
Yeah, so with the Plymouth, Plymouth as a style tends to be a little bit softer than some of our more traditional London dries. A lot of our benchmarks, like say a Beefeater or a Bombay Dry, so it's got a little bit of a softer edge to it, and that's something to be aware of because green chartreuse on its own is a 110 proof spirit, so it's got and it's a lot of big flavors, so it's got an edge to it. So trying to balance that out a little bit with those softer edges is a really nice little touch for it. So there are gins that get that kind of vibe for it. And what's nice about it is it does have a touch of citrusiness to it as well. So it's got a little bit of that lemon that's going to balance out some of those more herbal notes that we're getting from our other two components here. I've also played around a lot with like the Old Raj Blue Label. Because it's got that saffron, which I really like because the other version of chartreuse, the yellow, bumps up that saffron. So you've already got a complementary flavor that pours through on there. So I think that the gin gives you this, like I said, it's the place where you really get to play around with for your personal preference of what this personalizes this drink into. And I think that we're, again, lucky to be in a place where gin has had a resurgence, that you do have choices now versus maybe the one or two that you would have been able to find on a back bar, you know, 15, 20 years ago. So there's a lot of opportunity as an enthusiast and as a patron at a bar to be able to find some spaces to get into that. I think it's another good fun thing to point out about this drink is that you look at all three of these ingredients, they were all conceived originally as medicinal. Gin with that juniper, that Jennifer originally was meant to be kind of like that distillation of that element, vermouth with the wormwoods and the infusions of the botanicals on the wine, and chartreuse in its original form sold by monks on horseback in very concentrated amounts that you were able to get like a thimble full of. And you can still buy elixir vegetal in pharmacies in France. Like that's how much is culturally kind of ingrained into that idea. So, and that evolves into these other versions of it. And I think it's also kind of at this point where we start talking about the ingredients to kind of dive into the name a little bit, because bijou does mean jewel. And the urban legend, the drinking legend, the bar legend of where this name comes from is from the different colors of these ingredients. Gin for diamond, vermouth, sweet vermouth for ruby, and green chartreuse for emerald. You actually look at, you know, sweet vermouth. It's not really a ruby, but it's a great story, right? Like going back to that showmanship and pulling back the curtain. Mm-hmm. So
fantastic name there. And thank you for bringing that up, because I had meant to, or I had put it in my notes and just flew straight past it.
We're just so excited about the gin.
Here's another one for you, though, that I'd never considered that you really prompted here. So you talk about all of those different aspects, juniper, wormwood, all of everything that we don't know, but we know must be going into chartreuse.
Yeah.
It's funny that these are all considered medicinal ingredients or, you know, medicine, when they all have a distinct and on varying levels bitterness to them. And as humans, we've evolved to believe that bitter equals poison. That's why we don't like bitter things. So I don't know. That's really fascinating to me.
It is incredibly fascinating to me. And I also think that's also why you see like the sugar content you do in a lot of these things. I think that there's, you look at like an old fashioned, like the cocktail, it's bitter, sugar, spirit, water, and the bitters in there, like a good one, it's not meant to make the drink bitter. It's just enough to make you go, okay, the alcohol burn is lessening, and the sugar is not meant to make it sweet, really. It's just to balance out the bitter that you're adding together. So that's what these kinds of ingredients are hopefully doing appropriately. Huh. The vermouth and the chartreuse are adding in the sugar to help balance out some of the bittering elements of the gin, dialing it down a little bit, and hopefully you're getting that right balance for it, which is why the proportions can be such a big component about whether this drink is the best thing you've had all night or the worst thing you've had all year.
And you see, this is what we're talking about earlier. It's culture, it's history, it's all these fascinating little nuggets. I'm going to skip vermouth for a second and move us on to chartreuse there. Obviously, I'm sure you're a man with a lot more facts than most, and bartenders do love their chartreuse, but it seems like you might have learned a thing or two over the last 8 years at least.
I had a secret hookup.
Are there any fascinating little chartreuse factoids you want to call out here? Because I feel like it's an ingredient that people just love hearing about.
Oh, yeah. I mean, chartreuse is just fascinating. Chartreuse has been, for those unfamiliar, chartreuse is a product that's been made by the Cartusian monks in the French Alps for over 300 years. The legend goes they were given the recipe for the elixir of long life in 1605, and then it took them 150 years to perfect the formula, to wait for like all the botanicals to arrive through the spice road. It is a blend of 130 different herbs and botanicals through different macerations and distillations. It is something that the recipe is only known by two monks. And what I love about that too is that, unlike most people who start a liquor brand or who create alcohol, they didn't set out to become distillers. They came to the monastery to be monks, and they're like, great, you make the chartreuse now. And that's their job, because the Cartusian monks are a order of working monks, meaning that they work to pay their way. And the sales of chartreuse support most of the Cartusian monasteries throughout the world. That's also why there's such a big shortage for it. They're not motivated by this idea of like, oh, we want to generate more profits. It's no, this is as much time as we want to take out to make it. We're making enough for what we need. And it doesn't mean they're not interested in it. Overseas, there are so many different variations of chartreuse than what we get here in the United States. We are starting to see more of them. Chartreuse does come in two primary colors, as it were, the green, which is the original, which we're talking about here in the Bijou. And speaking of fun facts, the color chartreuse is actually named for the liqueur, not the other way around.
There you go.
And then the yellow, which is a little bit lower proof, higher concentration of saffron, honey. Then they make their aged versions, which they're called their VEPs, which have a very, very French name, which I never pronounced correctly, but essentially means very exceptionally long aged. And literally, they just age it until they feel like it's ready. So yeah, that's kind of the fun thing about chartreuse. It's been around forever, and it is actually one of the few liqueurs, spirits, as it were, that does evolve and change in the bottle. So depending on how old your bottle is, where it's coming from, it does evolve over time, which is not normally the case once you take it out of a barrel or an aging thing. Mm-hmm. And part of that's because it's not just a distillation. There are various macerations and infusions along the way hence why it's a natural green color at the end of the day. So there is, again, that kind of fun vibe of what's different now than it was before. So yeah, the recipe is the same, but like that bottle might be evolving on you over time in a good way.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And, you know, something we covered quite recently as well with our friend of the show, Aaron Goldfarb, and talking about vintage chartreuse, his new book, Dusty Booze. Go and check that episode out if you haven't, folks. Vintage Cocktails. We were talking about that too. And we also learned, or I believe Aaron was told by Joaquin Simo, a man who's drunk a fair amount of chartreuse in his time, that the base alcohol for it might actually be cognac, and that Joaquin at some point had a bottle of that base spirit. That's something I didn't know.
Oh, I'm not sure about that. That may at one point have been what they were using for it. I don't particularly know. I do know that I believe, if I'm, please go double check on these things. I know that one of them for these is a beet sugar distillate.
Right.
I believe the other one's a grape distillate.
So maybe that's what we're talking about there as well, because I certainly don't get a lot of that, you know. Also, with the color, it would be quite difficult to get that such a vibrant green.
They're definitely not doing like taking an aged cognac and turning that into two chartreuse these days, but they are starting with an eau de vie the same way you would start with a really good cognac. And moving along from that. So,
and as I understand it, this might be completely wrong too, and things might have changed, but I believe where they're based is definitely closer to cognac than, well, I just associate beet sugar alcohol production with champagne for some reason. I might be making that up.
They're making the distillate in the French Alps at their monastery, and that's like the biggest terroir factor that they're getting from that. You know, at the end of the day, both the beet sugar distillate and grape eau de vie are very French products,
right?
And this is a very French product that you're ending up with, so it's all coming from those spaces,
even down to the, when you hear the French pronounce it as well, it's a wonderful word. Vermouth, you've obviously mentioned that you're a proponent of keeping that in the fridge. Anything else you want to talk about specifically brands for this one too, because I do feel like you tend to get more, it depends how craft you go, right? Or, you know, how local the producer might be over there in Europe, but you tend to get more variation, in my opinion, with sweet vermouths than you do across the board with dry vermouths, right? Like, you know, people have their preferences, but the profiles aren't quite as wide.
Yeah. For my preference for this, I like a good Di Torino style sweet vermouth. My default for that is kind of like a Cokie Di Torino, because consistency, I trust that brand, and I trust what they do. But I like that flavor profile for it, because it's not as big as some of the other ones, like say a Carpano Antica or a Punta Mess, which are very big personalities on their own. And this is a drink that already, with that, like the chartreuse is the biggest personality in the room for this. So it's like, how do you complement that? I think about it like your very boisterous extroverted friend who's like the life of the party. Like, the rest of you are all fun, we love this, but like, that's okay. So how do we not have two of those people trying to dominate the conversation all night? How do we turn it into a flow where we're all having a good time versus a battle in the backseat?
And Antica Torino is another one that I've been drinking a fair amount of recently and thoroughly enjoying. Would you classify that? You said obviously Di Torino, but would you classify that in a kind of similar profile to Cokie?
Yeah, I would call that in the same kind of spaces for that. I think that the important thing for it is, like any cooking, taste your ingredients. See what you got. See what goes along for it. For me, it's like a vermouth that's a little bit lighter in body, since we are having such a big characteristic here, and especially because my preference leans into those kind of bigger navy strength gins. For this, it's something where it's like, okay, we don't want something that's going to be too big. It's about, how do we blend the two of these together? So for me, in this drink, the vermouth is the bridge between the gin and the chartreuse. So its job is to make sure those two are meeting in the middle versus trying to stand out on its own.
Very nice. I love that description there. Adam, any more ingredients that you want to talk about for this drink specifically before we maybe look a little bit into preparation?
Yeah, the one thing that we haven't touched on is the recipes does call for orange bitters.
Orange bitters, yeah.
Which, again, another little binding agent, kind of like the salt and sugar. Just a little bit of that extra citrusy notes that go along with there. The one thing I would just say, and I feel like this has been called out before in other episodes I've listened to, orange bitters have a vast variety.
Yeah.
So that you must absolutely taste what orange bitters you're using to make sure it's not too much artificial orange. Make sure it's got that real nice balance that goes along with it. And then just another fun note I really enjoy about this drink is in the original recipe, where it shows up with chartreuse, they call it, you can either use a cherry or an olive as a garnish. Please don't put an olive near this drink for me. I don't get that one, but
yeah, that's an interesting one right there. I'm just trying to figure out in my head how, in what world that combination works.
I don't know. I wonder if, like, you know, refrigeration, preservation, we didn't have as much access to a lot of big, fresh things back in the day. That's why you look at a lot of the old recipes from the late 1800s, 1900s, like nutmeg's the aromatic element, not like a citrus zest.
Yeah.
Because you can grate a lot of nutmeg and that'll last you a long time. You might not have fresh citrus for a zest the entire time. So I wonder if that's maybe what's going on here. Maybe what they're talking about is like our traditional like maraschino cherries, which would be preserved, and an olive, which also has a longer shelf life. So what do you have around that could work for it versus it necessarily being like, oh, we really think an olive complements this right now.
I mean, you know, it's also, maybe it's a custom at the time as well. You got to have something, sure, right? The drink has to come with something in it. And maybe at the time, yeah, it's fashionable to have something you can eat.
We drink with our eyes. We got to have something in
it. Yeah, very cool. Adam, do you want to talk us through your, I don't know whether this is a proprietary, whether this is a sacred recipe there, much like chartreuse over there. Do you want to talk about the bougie bijou in terms of what we're going through
absolutely.
Here? Because you've already given us your standard bijou recipe. So basically what I'm asking here is for a 2-for-1. Do you want to talk us through that preparation along with your spec, if that's okay?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the bougie bijou, you know, so this is a spirit for a drink. So this is a stirred cocktail. We're looking for that. Shaking and stirring both accomplish the same things for mixing a drink, chilling, dilution, and mixing. What shaking does that stirring doesn't is add aeration. And when we have a spirit for a drink like this, we don't want that aeration. We don't want to get that anything that we're looking for, that texture and that mouthfeel. So you set up a good mixing glass. And then, you know, just good rule of thumb when you're building something, especially when you have big ingredients like this, you kind of start with your smallest proportion and work your way up. So you're wasting the least. So I always start with my bitters. So I use Angostura orange bitters for this one, like the flavor profile on those. And then the secret for the bougie bijou is having access to chartreuse. Most people don't, and splitting the baseline. So I take about a quarter ounce of the elixir vegetale, which is, we're talking about the original version of chartreuse, that they kind of sweetened and lower the proof to turn to the green. But I take a quarter ounce of that with a half ounce of the chartreuse VEP green, to 3/4 ounce of Cocchi di Torino, and 1.5 ounces of my Navy Strength gin. Add ice, stir, and I keep my glassware in my freezer. So I keep, because we were talking about, like, this is a drink that we serve up. So that means that it's got nowhere to go after it starts to warm up. So the colder your glass, the colder, the longer that's going to keep for you. So especially in a restaurant setting, that's very important because I might be putting this up in the service well. So I want to make sure it's not going to be too warm by the time it gets to the table. And then garnish it with Kirschwasser cherries. So cherries that have actually been soaked in Kirschwasser. So you're getting a little bit of that cherry brandy aspect to go along with it. And you know, I've got some vintage glassware that we get to go fun with. Ooh. This one, but that's really the secret for that one. It's like really hitting that proper dilution, chill, and stir. Now, I do want to say, if you wanted to do this drink on the rocks, you absolutely could. There's nothing sacrilegious about that. The one thing I would call out then is you want to be conscious of your dilution level. You're not going to dilute this as much as you are if you're pouring it over a rock. Hopefully with the quality of your ingredients, you're using a big cube. Than you are if you're going to serve it up, because that ice is going to dilute a little bit over time. So it's going to give you that opportunity to let evolve in the glass on you a little bit. And the last thing, one of my biggest pet peeves is when I get a drink and it's like perfect right at the beginning, but then halfway through it's just mostly water. I'm like, okay. Like wish I could have sat with this a little bit longer. So that's just kind of one of those things I keep an eye out for. But yeah, that's the secret of the bougie bijou.
That sounds amazing. I need to get back out straight away there to try that. That's a, one other small thing though, that just occurred to me that between our conversation, speaking earlier about ratios and you just mentioned the serve there, which I never considered. If you want to serve this on the rocks, big rock, there's a world in which you can turn around and be like, oh, bijou, it's just a Negroni with green chartreuse in place of Campari.
You could like they're all in the same family, aren't they? Like, what are we playing around with here? Like that's actually a really interesting point that this does kind of fall in that Negroni style area. I would say that, yeah, especially because when you think about a Negroni, that Campari is kind of the big player in there as well to go along with that. I think it's interesting, though, that in kind of the modern cocktail bars, you are seeing more and more different, what we kind of generally call Italian Grand Bitters, things that are in the style of Campari that get very close. You don't really see anything that gets close to Chartreuse. Like the closest is maybe like a Genepi every now and then, but it doesn't have the same complexity.
For sure.
So that's a very interesting thought on that.
And that might make, you know, you were talking about sweetness earlier, but if you are stirring slightly and serving over that big rock, that might actually make it hold up. Who knows? I think I know what I'm doing this evening.
I think the really big difference between, say, like a Negroni in this kind of conversation versus a bijou is that the Negroni, the Campari, has such a elevated level of bitterness to go along with it that's not present in these other ingredients, which is why you don't add bitters to a Negroni, because you've already got that large element for it. So, you know, there's that. Yeah.
I wonder if or maybe a Chinar. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, we shouldn't be just, you know, trying to workshop cocktails on air here.
By the time we're done with this episode, we've just given someone their new barmaid.
Adam, any final thoughts on the bijou or anything we've covered in this episode up until this point before we hit our weekly questions?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. I just encourage you, if you haven't had a bijou, it's absolutely worth trying. And what I think is also wonderful about things like chartreuse and vermouth, if you're looking to play around with it at home, is there are 375 milliliter bottles of these available. You don't need to make a commitment to a big buy all the time. You can get something and play around with it and see where it takes you. Because like you're saying at the top, like buying a bottle of chartreuse is one of those drinks that you can just kind of naturally find yourself falling into, just trying to find a way to experiment with that bottle. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thought, a wonderful way to use some of these ingredients and spend some time.
And especially these days with the chartreuse situation, popularity is what I'm going to say instead of situation.
Absolutely.
Might be easier to find a 375. So top tip right there. Adam, we're going to do it. We're going to kick off the final questions of today's show with number one, as always. What style or category of spirit enjoys the most real estate on your back bar?
For me right now, it's whiskey. It involves the most real estate on the back bar. But that's kind of if you consider like whiskey as a whole. You know what I mean? Like falling into that stuff, the aged spirits. But what you're seeing more and more and more, especially in Los Angeles, is the agave section growing and growing and growing. And but what I love is that it's not just tequila and the full range of Blanco, Repo, and Añejo of an individual brand, but more and more Mexican-owned traditional style mezcals. Mm-hmm. And not even just that, ricillas, sotols, bacanoras. Like you're seeing this exploration. And I'm a little spoiled being in Southern California and Los Angeles that, you know, that's kind of where a lot of it goes, that I get to see a lot of that. But, you know, I love those spirits and I love them both as a mixer, but also as something to sip on in that more traditional way.
I had a Bacanora at a bar in LA in that recent visit, which walking into that bar definitely was not what I expected. I would have been able to find a Bacanora on the menu. It wasn't Musso and Frank, though I'm not sure they carry Bacanora either. But question number two, which ingredient or tool do you believe to be the most undervalued in a bartender's arsenal?
Not so much a tool, but as a skill. I think proper knife skills is one of the most undervalued things for a bartender. I was actually just talking with one of my chefs this past week, and he was learning a bit about the bar, wanted to know about what we were doing. I was walking through that, and he's like, "If there's anything I can do for you," and I was like, "Honestly, chef, I would love for my bartenders to learn how to use a knife from someone who uses a knife every day." He was like, "Oh, absolutely." I think it's one of those things where talk about like garnish and prep and all those things, like, but also just like strain on your body. The amount of us that hold a knife wrong, and if you're doing that repetitive motion all day long, like that was a game changer for me when I got those lessons. So
lesson number one as well, sharpen those knives.
Sharpen like those knives. You'll hurt yourself on a dull blade more than you will on a sharp one.
Yep, that can do some damage to you. I like that. As a former chef, I'm into that answered right there. Question three, what's the most important piece of advice you've received while working in this industry?
Most important piece, self-care and work-life balance. You know, I've been very fortunate to work with some of the best in this industry. And the people you see last make time for mental health and physical health, something I do very well. And it is very unfortunate that we see so many of our friends, you know, not be here. Mm-hmm. And that is something that the lifestyle, late nights, long hours, can do a lot to you. If you've watched The Bear, you've got an idea for it. So, anyone out there who is in this industry, like, make time for self-care.
Mm-hmm. Fine words there. Fine advice as well. And yeah, burnout is real. Those kind of things. Question number four. If you could only visit one last bar in your life, what would it be?
Oh, that is... I've been thinking about this question since you sent over. I'm going to cheat. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you two answers. Both of them are in Tokyo. One is a bar Benfitic. I had an opportunity to sit at that bar after 3 years of trying last year. And it was one of those experiences where, you know, I don't often sit at a bar for 3 hours. We were there for 3 hours just tasting everything. A guy, he is a farmer who's literally just bringing his farm to the bar every day. But the second answer to that is, I actually don't even know the name of the bar. The very first time I ever went to Tokyo, got there and we were trying to go to a very famous bar, and we got there and we're waiting at the door and there's a long way. And we're like, you know, this is a great bar. It looks like a great bar, but we've been to this bar. We're privileged. We get a chance to let's go find some Tokyo. And we just started wandering around and we're like, I think that sign means there's a bar up there. And we took an elevator up to the fifth floor and we walked in and we accidentally walked into a private club and we were politely asked to leave. We turned around and right behind us, there was another bar and we said, well, let's try it. And we walked in and they welcomed us in and barely spoke any English, ordered some Suntory highballs. They brought every Suntory product that they had off the back bar. So I wanted to make sure we knew which one we were getting, like what's going on for it. You know, the business guys next to us ended up buying us the last pour of the BK21 that was there. Watched the bartender cut a passion fruit in half to make a porn star martini and creme brulee the other half as the garnish. And then walked us out the door with a little snack for the road. And to this day, no idea what the name of that bar was, but I've told that story so many times that I wish I did, because I'm sure I'd be sending people there all the time. But like when we talk about, like, what's the last bar in your life that I'd want to go, it's I think about that experience, of that moment of hospitality, of that surprise, that shock, of warmness of walking into something like that. That's I want that experience again.
Would you be able to find it if you were there again, or is it one of those?
Trust me, I have tried. I vaguely know where it is.
Yeah.
And if we spent like maybe a good afternoon just going for it, I'm pretty sure we'd be able to. But definitely not looking.
What a phenomenal story that is. All right, then. Last question for today. If you knew that the next drink was going to be your last, what would you order or make?
Drink or cocktail?
Drink.
Drink.
It says cocktail. I just changed the wording there. No, usually we say cocktail. The reason I said drink there is because some folks have often turned around and said champagne, and I'm like, that's a fine answer.
Oh, that's very fair. Well, I was going to say if it's drink, you know, I'm a whiskey man, and I've been very fortunate enough to curate single barrels for programs I've run over the years, and I still have a couple of bottles of the very first barrel that I ever purchase for a bar, which was over 10 years ago now.
Oh, wow.
It was a single barrel of Elijah Craig 12-year in the old squat bottle with the actual age statement on. So it's a drink, and it's the last thing you have. I want to have some of that left.
Yeah.
But for a cocktail, it's going to be a 5-to-1 gin martini with a lemon twist, preferably Tanqueray number 10.
Yes.
That'd be it. You know, 5-to-1.
Any bitters in there?
No, not for me.
No,
not on that one. No. I like it without that, just that twist. And I joke all the time. I'm just wandering around Los Angeles teaching bartenders math whenever I order this. So
2.5 to 0.5 people, right?
Exactly.
There we go. That's my ratio as well, Adam. Or it is these days, you know, it changes over time.
But it changes over time.
I love it, man, after my own heart. Well, listen, before we wrap things up, just want to say to the folks, the listeners here, don't forget, we got the email address, cocktailcollege@vinepair.com. Listen, if you go out there after this, if you make the bougie bijou, if you make the classic bijou, if you make the, basically it's a Negroni, but it's with chartreuse instead, if you're working on that, reach out, let us know how that goes. Adam, they can find you at Spago, but where else can they find you? Where else are you? Are you on the socials?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm, if you want to come have a drink with me, I recently, as of last year, took over the bar program for Spago in Beverly Hills, Wolfgang Puck's original restaurant. We've completely redone the bar, the program. We actually just finished a massive remodel. So you're literally sitting down at brand new seats in a 42-year-old icon, which is a lot of fun. On the socials, I am Bottled in Bond LA. Like the whiskey. It's also my blog. I do spirits writing stuff on there. On TikTok with the same, because, you know, gotta stay with the kids.
Yeah.
Of legal drinking age. those are the big spots for me. And I also travel around a lot with Diageo's World Class for their educational platforms as well. So
fantastic stuff. Adam, we've kept you far too long, but it's been an engaging conversation. It's been a wonderful time. Thank you so much and look forward to getting you back for sometime in the future.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. I look forward to joining you for the next tangential diatribe conversation.
I'll be out there for that the bougie bijou. I promise I'll have learned how to say it by then. In the meantime, cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the Cocktail College podcast. If you enjoy listening to the show anywhere near as much as we enjoy making it, go ahead and hit subscribe and please leave a rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, whether that's Apple, Spotify, or Stitcher. And please tell your friends. Now for the credits. Cocktail College is recorded in New York City and produced by myself and Darby Seasai, who also composed our awesome theme music. Just give that a listen. I also want to give a huge shout out to everyone on the VinePair team, especially co-founders Adam Teeter and Josh Malin, editor-in-chief Joanna Sherino, and art director Daniel Greenberg, who designed our killer logo. Finally, thank you, listener, for making it this far and for giving this whole thing a purpose. Until next time. Cocktail College is brought to you today by Tanqueray. I don't know about you, listener, but I'm one of those people that needs a mobile app to track my budget. And I'm going to let you into a little secret. I actually have a line item on mine marked Tanqueray. It's true, because I'm a gin martini drinker and Tanqueray is my martini gin. I'm not ashamed to admit it. I have a Tanqueray monthly budget. But it's not just for martinis. Now, I turn to Tanqueray for any of the gin classics, because it always delivers on that classic London Dry profile. You know, Tanqueray's, it's not like a good friend, it's like a best friend, a dependable stalwart that always delivers. Now, if you're looking for cocktail inspiration, well, you know you've come to the right place, but if you're looking for something tailored specifically for Tanqueray, you should head over to www.tanqueray.com now, because you know what, listener? When it comes to gin cocktails, you deserve the best.